Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. You may also listen to the Island Issues podcast online at lava1053.com or at koacountry1077.com. You click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. And that would include listening to last week's talk story with retired Rear Admiral David Titley, who was the Navy's climatologist and meteorologist and now does consulting work mostly for the federal government about the national security implications of climate change. And that's what we're going to talk again about this morning. Admiral Titley was here in early January, and I want to mention that because he was here before the new president was even put into place. And we had some very interesting conversations about what might happen in the next 4 years. That's included in the upcoming segment, along with what the Navy is actually doing to address the climate change issues that will affect them most deeply, which is sea level rise. Admiral Titley was on the island for the Waimea Ocean Film Festival, which comes up the first week of January every year. And this year had some particularly thought-provoking films and speakers, and I was just really glad to get him into the studio. In the film, The Age of Consequences, and then a little bit last week, Admiral Titley talked about how some of the impacts of climate change, such as severe drought or too much rain and flooding, helped cause events as dramatic as the Syrian Civil War, and how, for example, in 2010, there was a drought in Russia, they couldn't produce enough wheat, they stopped selling wheat to Egypt, and that helped foment Arab Spring, things that I had not really understood. When we stopped the conversation last week, we were just talking about why climate change has become such a politicized issue, particularly given that the first President Bush, George H.W. Bush, called himself the environmental president and tried to make some changes that would address things like climate change. But clearly now there's a definite divide between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And so we pick up our conversation where Admiral Titley continues to talk about that topic.
I think Al Gore meant tremendously well. But when he so closely associated himself with this, there were so many Republicans that said, if Al Gore is for it, I'm against it. And ever since then, we've seen the increasing partisan divide. Nowadays, we almost think of the 1990s as the good old days when people could get things done. So I think there have been a number of these issues, and it's going to be very interesting to see how some of the Republicans, how some of the conservatives can kind of get themselves off this creaking tree branch. And I hope my left of center friends don't use this to try to like drive a stake through their heart, because when somebody kind of like does the finger in the chest and says you're a flat earther and you're stupid, does that really change people's minds? I think honestly, President Obama missed a great opportunity. If your listeners remember when Putin went into Crimea, Obama said this is bad, he shouldn't do it. But we need to give him an exit ramp. We need to give him a face-saving strategy. So if the president was offering Putin that, why couldn't he offer the Republicans an equivalent face-saving strategy on climate change? But he was said, hey, you guys are flat earthers, you're deniers. That probably, it certainly made his base feel good. It energizes your base. But I have yet to meet anybody after insulting them that says, you know, Titley, you're right. I'm glad you insulted me.
Right,
I now see it
you.
Your way. You know, that somehow that just hasn't happened for me.
So, interesting question. What should have been done to allow those who are climate deniers understand that there's perhaps science that supports the other view, that there actually is climate change and it is damaging and we can do something about it?
I think the real answer is I don't know what the answer is, but I'm okay admitting that. So I think when you don't know for sure, what you do is you try a lot of different stuff. You know, sort of like if you're in marketing or advertising, what do? You test out your campaigns. It's like, well, that didn't work. Oh, this one really worked. Let's go with it. So you could test out a number of things. But I find that a lot of conservative folks are, in fact, for energy security. they're really quite in favor for renewable, even non-carbon-based energy. Where's the discussion on nuclear? Now, that can be very, to the environmental movement, that can be very divisive. But is there a place, if we're talking about gigawatt-scale non-carbon-based energy, does nuclear have or not have a role in that? If you can make it sound like, hey, I'm really trying to address this issue and not get all my other sort of social causes kind of rolling in under the tent, then I think you can start to have that conversation. But my guess is starting leading with the science of 97% of climate scientists, that's probably not going to be the way to do it. So I would recommend downplaying that, but then play up how do we get ourselves to a non-carbon-based energy system? What are the opportunities, the economic opportunities, the social opportunities, the security opportunities? Because if you can convert the energy system, you've kind of won. And if somebody still wants to go fight about the science, hey, you know, have a great day. They can go do that.
I know you've actually addressed this, but the question very specifically is, what is the solution to climate change? Is just getting off fossil fuel, getting off oil, is that the solution?
Well, that's a huge part of the solution. Now, you know, when you say fossil, I would say fossil fuels in general. So natural gas is certainly better than coal. It's per unit of energy, it's roughly half the amount of CO2. It also has a whole lot less of like bad stuff like mercury and particulates and things that cause, just put aside the climate issue, I mean, just have tremendous human health implications. So to do that, how do you then change your transportation system? How do you modify things like your buildings so that you can reduce energy? In the United States, I can't speak for Hawaii, but in the United States writ large, we roughly waste about a third of our water, a third of our energy, and a third of our food. So how do we build things, not so that they're painful and not so that we feel like we're living in a cave with a hair shirt, but how do we build things so that we greatly reduce those wastages, while at the same time, how do you electrify your transportation system? How do you generate large quantities of affordable non-carbon-based energy? And what I tell people, maybe it's a little bit utopian, but I mean, I don't want to go backwards in quality of life. I want to go forwards. I want to have a better life for my children, my grandchildren, if I had any, or at least for future generations, than we've had in the past. And I honestly think we can do that. And we can do that not only for the United States, but frankly for the world, because this is a global issue. How do we help the 1 to 2 billion people today who have no power? None. Is building coal-fired power plants the right way? I would argue no. So how can we put these, you know, distributed, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, microgrids, how do we sort of take them from the 17th century to the 21st century? You know, and of course, cell phones are somewhat of an example of that. There are large parts of the world that never had landlines. They went from no telephone to having a cell phone. So what's the energy analog to that? So that it's not just the United States that enjoys a better quality of life, but honestly, the rest of the world as well.
In our recent election, issues got virtually no time, and certainly the issue of climate change was really low down on the list of things that got talked about at all. But Donald Trump famously stated that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. And at first glance, it would look like some of the people he's putting into cabinet positions may in fact share that view or have a similar view. So question for you, Admiral David Titley, is over the next many years, what do you see as the possibilities for where we might be going from a federal level?
You know, near term, it's very hard to say what the president is going to do. I mean, I think we've all seen, yes, we've seen on a number of issues what look like declarative quotes on Twitter. Here's my position. And then we find out we are chastised collectively for taking him literally and not figuratively, right? I think that's the phrase. So what does that mean? That means anything I put out on Twitter, I guess I don't really have to stand by. But maybe that's an advantage for climate. Maybe that means that if the right person gets in the door, you know, I'm not sure the president actually has any real hard views on, well, I'm not sure on anything, but I'm not sure on climate. So yes, he's tweeted these things, but he also tweeted that he was going to, you know, dismantle Obamacare. And then he talks to the president and says, you know, maybe this is okay. He talked about torture, which scares just about every military person because it's illegal. I mean, to start with, we could do a whole show on that. But he then talks to General Mattis, his designee for Secretary of Defense, and General Mattis says, it doesn't really work. I'd get him a beer and a cigarette and I could find out more. And then, you know, Trump says, maybe that's a better answer. So although, yes, I've seen the tweets and I've quoted them, I'm not sure that, unlike most politicians, he even cares what he said before. And I think that could actually be an advantage. So there's all the way, I've actually have four scenarios. But the most dangerous scenario would be he appoints competent but evil people. The most likely scenario is he appoints incompetent and ideologues, but really have no idea how the government works. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. My guess is many of these appointees will probably not be around in about 2 years, because I think the career civil servants are going to run rings around them. I've told all my media friends in the Washington Post and New York Times, you are living in tall cotton because you will have leaks greater volume than the Mississippi River starting on the 20th of January. And, you know, when we saw this with President Reagan, he tried to shut down the EPA. He had Anne Borsuch, I believe. She lasted less than 2 years. And it was ugly. So my guess is we'll see things like that. So competent and dangerous, incompetent but ideologues, and don't understand the government. The third for climate is he simply has bigger fish to fry, and it just gets ignored. So it's not like he shows leadership, it's not like anything moves forward, but it's not a war on climate. I think if there's a war, it's going to be a war on regulation, and my guess is Clean Power Plan is, you know, in the crosshairs for that. But the fact is as the economics are, natural gas is cheaper than coal in most of the U.S. I'm sure, you know, Hawaii is clearly a different case, but for the mainland, natural gas is cheaper, and that alone is going to basically get us to the goals of the Clean Power Plan without all the regulation. The fourth scenario is Nixon to China. And Nixon to China, of course, is, you know, does Trump, because is there a messenger that he listens to? And who knows who that is? But is there a messenger that he listens to and says, yeah, this makes sense. We do need to do something. If we either put a tax on carbon or we get serious in investment in renewables, and I can get that through the Congress, because right now we honestly haven't really been serious about investment. If climate is as big a deal as President Obama said it is, I can't see it in the budget, because there is no budget that's really reflected this. It's possible President Trump could surprise us all, me included, and be a force for good in this. Now, I'm not saying that's likely, but when President Nixon was elected, who thought he would fundamentally change the relationship with China? So, and we've seen with Trump that he just doesn't seem to put much weight in whatever it is he said in the past. So I don't know who that messenger is, but I'll tell you, if I could figure out who he or she is, I'd try to get her or him into the White House as soon as I could.
Well, it sort of sounds like one of his key advisors is his daughter, Ivanka, She did bring Al Gore to meet with herself and President Trump, which I found fascinating. I found it fascinating that she invited him in. I also find it fascinating, nothing to do with climate change, but she's a big advocate for helping fund childcare, which has not really been a Republican initiative.
Right.
So maybe it's Ivanka. Who knows?
Yeah, we don't know. I think we have elected a president who probably will not fit any traditional mold. Now, whether that is a great thing or a not such a great thing, we will all get to find out. But I think we have a very, very different model coming in. And I tell my climate friends who work this issue that, you know, that's the reality. You know, you need to get to stage six of acceptance, get through your grief, anger, despair, and understand that's the reality. But when you get there, you have to look for the opportunities as well.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues, and I'm Sherry Bracken. We're talking today with retired Rear Admiral David Titley. He was with the Navy as their main climatologist and navigator and meteorologist, and now does consulting work in the area of climate change and specifically how it impacts national security. So we're really covering sort of a wide range of that aspect. Next Sunday morning, we begin a two-week discussion about our state judiciary. The first is a repeat of a talk story I did with Associate Justice Sabrina McKenna back in 2011 that covers some of the very interesting things about how our judiciary works and also about her life. The week after that, we do a one-on-one with Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald, which I recorded here in Kona when he came to visit. You may join me for Island Issues every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And the Island Issues interviews are then posted online, so you can listen anytime, lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Just click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. So let's get back to our conversation with retired Rear Admiral David Titley. And a reminder that we recorded this conversation when he was here for the Waimea Ocean Film Festival in early January and was featured in the film The Age of Consequences, which, although it's a depressing film, I recommend you see it if you have the opportunity. If you're watching the Super Bowl this afternoon, have a great time and be safe. The Navy seems to be the service that may be most affected by climate change for a number of reasons. What specifically has the Navy been doing to address this for themselves?
As you mentioned at the beginning, we started back in, I shouldn't say we anymore because I left in 2012, but the U.S. Navy initiated under the Chief of Naval Operations, basically the head military guy, this task force on climate change. And really what we started to look at first was the Arctic. We haven't talked much about the Arctic here, but the Arctic is in fact changing faster than any place else on the Earth. It's primarily a maritime environment. It's an ocean surrounded by land. What not everybody realizes is there's actually a couple of million permanent residents north of the Arctic Circle. So it is not like Antarctica where there's only penguins and nobody else, but there's millions of people who, just like Native Hawaiians, consider this their home, the Native Alaskans, the Sami people, the First Nation people in Canada, they all, the Inuit, they all consider that their home. And it is. It's their home just as much as Hawaii is for Native Hawaiians. But it's changing, you know, as fast as we see changes down here, multiply that by 10, by 20 up in the Arctic. But from a security perspective, as the Arctic opens, and again, without presupposing who's our friend and who's our enemy, it is sovereign territory of the United States. We have Alaska up there. It is potential in the decades to come that at least seasonally significant trade routes can move through there. You'll probably have significant increases in tourism, possibly fishing, possibly mineral extraction. Again, if oil stays cheap, it's a hard place to do business up in the Arctic. But if oil gets expensive again, and the only thing I've ever learned about oil prices is anybody who says they can predict them, put your hand on your wallet and back away. Nobody really can predict these things. So if it gets expensive again and seems to stay, let's say, north of $120 a barrel or so, I expect you'll see pressure by the big oil companies to drill up there. So the U.S. has economic interest, social interest, sovereignty interest. The United States Navy goes where the U.S. government has interest. And that's why we're in the South China Sea. It's why we're in the Middle East. So what the Navy needs to do is to be ready to work on the surface seasonally. Now, that doesn't mean the Navy's going to build icebreakers. We're not going to do that, I don't think. But there is just a whole lot of technical characteristics to being able to operate at those very high latitudes. Communications are different. It's a very austere infrastructure. You better bring what you need because you're not going to go down to the Walmart to pick it up. Charting is you know, maybe 5% of the Arctic Ocean is charted to modern standards, and the rest of it is very, you know, either uncharted or very unreliable. Weather forecasting is about 40 years behind the rest of the world in its accuracy up there. So there's lots of technical things. Just how do you make a surface ship work, even if there's no ice, but if the water is like 28 or 29 degrees Fahrenheit? We know how to do it, but you need to build in things and design things into your ship, which the U.S. Navy has not yet done. So there's a lot of work just getting people familiar with that theater. There's a lot of work there. The sea level rise you mentioned, the Navy has partnered with other government firms like the Army Corps of Engineers, like NOAA, to try to get a better handle on all those local details, like in their big Navy bases, San Diego, Norfolk, and I think Pearl Harbor. I don't know how much they've looked at Pearl. I think they've done some looking at Pearl to try to really understand you know, how many decades do you have until you really got to start putting money in? Because this is going to be big, big dollars of some kind of defenses. And they need to know when they got to start putting that money into the budget. So I'll stop there on the Navy, but that's what they've been doing. And if anybody's interested, if you Google just U.S. Navy Arctic Roadmap or U.S. Navy Climate Roadmap, all the documents are out on the web. They're all unclassified. Anybody is welcome to research them, look at them, and see what the United States Navy is doing on this issue.
On September 21st in 2016, the National Intelligence Council issued its most recent report on the implications of climate change for U.S. national security. And as I understand it, the National Intelligence Council is a consortium of all the U.S. intelligence agencies together. Did this report, number one, sort of support what we're talking about relative to climate change, the conclusion that it's happening and we need to do something and it has implications for us internationally as well as nationally?
Absolutely. And again, this is another report that is actually out on the internet. It's, I think, 13 pages long. For a government report, I have to put that caveat in, but for a government report, it's written amazingly well.
It's, and it's like, only 13 pages, yay.
It uses English. There are even some pictures in there, so it's not even 13 pages of text. It is clearly written, and I think it's really quite powerful because, as you mentioned, Sherry, the National Intelligence Council is not a political body. It is our most senior intelligence professionals. They served in the Clinton administration, in the Bush administration, in the Obama administration, and now they will continue to serve in the Trump administration. So they are just kind of charged with calling the balls and strikes as they can best divine the tea leaves of the future. But with very high confidence, they have a collection of, I think it's 16 or 17 different intelligence agencies throughout the United States government, collectively said, this is something we need to pay attention to. And it's going to be, to me, very interesting to see how the Trump administration responds to this national intelligence estimate. And do they take it? What do they do? And I think this will be something we're going to find out here really quite soon.
Well, Congress is the body charged with making laws and providing funding. So you've touched on this, saying that in some cases, you think members of Congress are hearing from their constituents that there is concern. What do you see as the willingness of Congress to address research and funding that is going to be necessary if we're going to make strides?
So, of course, we've got a new Congress convened early in January. So we're going to have to see how the dynamics play out. But being able to, I think I mentioned this at the end of one of the Waimea showings of Age of Consequences here, is while it's all interesting whatever a particular administration does, with be it presidential memorandums and policies and roadmaps and, you know, strategic plans and all that, as you mentioned, you know, just read the Constitution. Who makes laws and who has the power of the purse? And it's the Congress. It's not the administration, it's the Congress. And to really move forward on the fundamental solutions for climate change, we need laws. And we honestly, in my view, I think we need to significantly increase research on, when I say non-carbon power, it's not only the generation, but it's the ability to store, it's the ability to move, it's the ability to manage that power so that everybody can have affordable non-carbon-based power. And we're going to see. You know, I have talked to quite a few Republicans who off the record say, hey, Titley, I totally get it. But I also get the politics in my state, in my district, and right now it's political suicide for me. There's a gentleman named Bob Inglis, who some of your listeners may have heard of. He was a Republican, very conservative Republican from upstate South Carolina. He was the ranking member when the Democrats controlled the Congress. He was the ranking Republican member of the House Science Committee. And back in 2009, then Congressman Inglis famously said, well, there could be something to this climate thing, and we might want to look at it. Now, he wasn't like, you know, chaining himself to the White House fence for a $200 a ton carbon tax. He said, maybe we should look at this. So he went from being elected with about 65 to 67% of his district to losing his primary by 30 points.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, this is South Carolina, which is a state impacted by...
This was upstate. This was upstate. Okay. This was a House election. It wasn't statewide. But it was basically a warning shot to many other Republicans to say, you know, irrespective of the science or what we need to do, this is like sticking your finger in a 440-volt socket while your feet are in salt water. It's political suicide. So one of the reasons that I go around and talk about this issue and spend far too many miles sitting on an airplane is that ultimately the Congress, in fact, does respond to the constituents. I tell people the Congress won't lead, but they can be led. They have a pretty good feel of what is and what is not important to their constituents, and also what the intensity level is. So I'm sure, you know, many people have seen the polls that there is a majority of people who say, yes, the climate is changing, and even a majority of people who say, we're pretty sure we understand why. There's a big man-made component, which there is. But it sort of rates out as number 15 on your top 10 list. And that means, I don't get any points for voting for it. I might get schwacked, like Bob Inglis. And then, you know, and I'm being kind of pure about this, and you start adding big money from fossil fuels or power companies or whatever, well, that can further tip the scales. So what I tell people is ultimately enough people need to care enough. And when people raise their hand and say, well, Titley, hey, that's all well and good, but what can I do? I simply ask, I have a llama, because we all know that cats are the way to go viral on the internet, and I don't have a cat, but I have a llama. The first L stands
you,
for...
You actually really do have a llama?
Well, I wish I did. I have
okay,
a virtual
just checking.
Llama. I have a llama on my PowerPoint slide. How's that? The first L is learn, and we can talk about that. The second L is local actions, things you can do that reduce your personal carbon footprint while leading the life you have. So let's say if you're a farmer or a rancher or a producer out west, I'm not saying you should like get rid of your F-250 and try to run your ranch on a Prius. That's not what I'm saying. But where you can do things, do them. M is monitor. Monitor for when I talk to my science friends, it turns out that our monitoring ability of climate change is basically held together by string and baling wire. We need to do better on that. But also monitor what your politicians are saying and doing. And then the A, maybe the most important one, is advocacy. And all I ask that people do is ask your politicians at any level, ma'am, sir, what are you doing to stabilize the climate? It's kind of an open-ended question. It's like dating 101. You don't want to ask a yes or no question on the first time. Because if you go down, oh, cap and trade is bad, and let me tell you why, or carbon tax is bad, okay, fine. Maybe they are bad. But tell me what you're going to do to stabilize the climate. And you can hopefully get a discussion. But even if you don't get a discussion, you know, in that reptilian politician brainstem in the way back in the wherever it is, you know, it registers that somebody cared. And if enough people care enough, that will change things. Lots of people can help on that. The media can help on that. I mean, we've seen with gay rights, we saw how fast that changed. And it's interesting when I talk to some of my gay rights friends, you know, they had for years and years, and they'd put a ton of money into it, a very legalistic argument, and nobody cared. Honestly, nobody cared. And then you had things like Will and Grace. And they changed the message. And the message became a very simple one. It's like, you know, as a heterosexual couple, you love your spouse. We love our spouse, too. This is really nothing more than human love, period. And everyone said, yeah, you know, you're kind of right. And boom, the U.S. changed dramatically in what, 4 years, 5 years, 3 years? I mean, it was incredible. And I think it surprised some of the gay rights movement as much as it surprised anyone else. So things can change, even when they, you know, and of course there are differences. I know there are differences. I know there's big money. I know there's a fossil fuel. I get that. But the point is they didn't give up. And people who care about climate and climate issues should not give up. You never know what the message is going to be. But if you can get the public on your side, the Congress is going to follow.
Admiral David Titley, before we say aloha, what else would you like to add?
Well, just again, Sherry, thanks so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure. This has been my first trip to the Big Island. I have enjoyed every moment of it. You have a wonderful, wonderful sense of community here, not to mention the spectacular physical beauty of the of the island. And I've just been so happy that so many people at the Waimea Film Festival and Ms. Tanya Howard's work on this has, I mean, I'm seeing full houses coming out to this Age of Consequences. And my first reaction is, man, it's a beautiful day outside. Why are you inside in a movie theater? But then I remember that every day is a beautiful day in Hawaii. So maybe that's how they find the time. But I'm just so happy to see so many people concerned about this issue, because ultimately that's what's going to get us to change.
Thank you so much, Admiral David Titley, for taking time out of your trip to talk with us. We really appreciate it. Aloha.
Thank you, Sherry. Thank you.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for being with us. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. I will see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.